It was still in an era where we were operating from the assumption that the monster was ostensibly supposed to be frightening and not actually sexually attractive to
that
women.
That was a deep, deep subtext. No one could admit.
Give us my boyfriend!
That gave me actual chills.
50s beefcakes, before people figured out lifting weights.
And we're back. Hey, guys.
Woo!
Woo! Welcome back to the Crowded Theater. I'm Kyle.
I'm Taylor.
I am Cliff.
Yeah, no, we have had a fun, we're wrapping up our spooky October here on the Crowded Theater, and we have seen some fun October movies. We're actually fresh off of coming back from
Young Frankenstein.
Yes, indeed we did. We saw Young Frankenstein today at 11:30 a.m. on a Sunday in a very crowded theater. Like it says on the TV behind Cliff. It was actually surprising. We were worried that maybe seeing at 11:30 it would not be crowded, but in fact, there was a big audience, lots of laughs, and it was rather kick-ass.
It's a great sign for cinema.
You know, it's big. It's more people in that than in Joker or Megalopolis, sadly. We're seeing Young Frankenstein. And then yesterday, Cliff's birthday, on the 26th, we went to
Back to the Future Day, October 26th, the day Marty McFly goes back in time.
Exactly, exactly. That, on October 26th, we saw Creature from the Black Lagoon, the original 1954 Creature from the Black Lagoon, on the big screen, also at the Alamo. So yeah, some really cool movies to wrap up the month, and they were both fun. I think, Taylor, you had not seen, you'd seen part of Young Frankenstein.
I had seen parts of Young Frankenstein and nothing of Creature from the Black Lagoon, than obviously the iconic poster.
And we once did a Creature from the Black Lagoon puzzle, I think.
Possibly, yeah.
Something
with your
like
sister.
That. Yeah, something like that. No, but that was really fun. Cliff, was it a good birthday present, Creature from the Black Lagoon?
It was an excellent birthday present. Yeah. First of all, because the pickings were slim, there were not a ton of new movies to see that were good and worth seeing, and it was just kind of an oddball pick right in the middle of the afternoon. I felt that Destiny was there. It was a 4:30 screening.
You were feeling
number,
fishy.
My lucky number is 43, so there had to be something going on there.
There you go.
Plus, my birthday is in a water sign, so Creature from the Black Lagoon. There's got to be
something. These are all good signs.
Something funky going on there. So, and it was an excellent screening. It was great to see. Seen the movie once before on streaming years ago, and definitely great to get the full theater experience, everyone reacting to it. Very kind of varied audience. We had just kind of an annoying couple to our right that clearly was there in the so bad it's good kind of a realm and was kind of cackling at it.
Thankfully I missed out on all
that. That was kind of annoying, but most of the people there were there for good reasons. For good reasons. And yes, it was a very effective fun for it was very fun for what it was.
Yeah, no, it was really cool. Well, Taylor, how did you enjoy Creature from the Black Lagoon?
I really liked it. I thought it was a really cool movie. I did, going into it completely blind, I assumed it would be some sort of, like, toxic waste monster type of a movie. So when it kind of had the archaeology, very hard science-based plot to it, I was kind of excited about that.
Yeah, the atomic thing was a good guess. Science was big then. The atomic age was British. We're talking the mid-50s, I think. What year is it? Like 54 or something like that?
I believe it is 54.
So it was an excellent guess. Atomic movies were all the rage then.
Yes, it was 54, the year our father was born. So there you go. A year to which we are cosmically connected. No, Creature from Black Lagoon, it was cool. Yeah, wouldn't have otherwise seen it probably if it wasn't your birthday, but I'm glad we did. And surprisingly interesting to see, I think, back-to-back with Young Frankenstein, because we're seeing with Young Frankenstein a parody version of sort of the very inception of, like, science-based horror and all of that. And then we're seeing a movie from the mid-50s at sort of the peak of the sort of, the disenchanted world, where everything was about science and evolution. And that movie, like, literally begins explaining the theory of evolution from the beginning.
It begins with,
like,
a 50s classroom science film about what evolution is and how life came from the seas. Just to ground us thoroughly in science before the monster comes out.
Yes, because it, of course, would be silly to say that, you know, the creature came from some old legend or some old spooky, like it says in Young Frankenstein, monsters, ghouls, those things are passé. This is the 20th century.
There wasn't a tribe worshipping it as a god like King Kong from 33.
Yes,
the 30s, very different from the 50s than the supernatural monsters of Universal in the 30s and whatnot.
Exactly. This is the 50s, so they're instead, they'll be said, they're like, did you know that there's a goober fish that lives in Amazonia that has lungs? And that somehow is a better explanation for a monster. But anyway, we'll get to Creature from the Black Lagoon. I was just very excited to see Young Frankenstein in theaters because Taylor has seen the first half of Young Frankenstein
several times.
Several times, at least once before falling asleep. But then we showed up today to a really packed house and saw the movie. So Taylor, now that you've seen all of Young Frankenstein, including the putting on the Ritz sequence, what was your take on it?
I will say, I think that the comedy of specifically, because I love Gene Wilder, mm-hmm. but I think the comedy of Young Frankenstein does better and reads better when in a crowd. Mm-hmm. I feel like it was a lot, because I remember even commenting at home, be like, I don't know if I get these jokes. But hearing the smattering or the clustering of different people laughing at different jokes or different timings of different mm-hmm. jokes was very fun and very well played. Like,
It's great audience reactions, and I think that's one of those movies that sometimes, even like when I was a kid, I think I've seen this movie so many times that the first time I ever saw Terry Gar do the roll in the hay gag, I just thought mm-hmm. it was funny because she was rolling in the hay, and who wouldn't want to roll in hay? I was a kid, and then like later on, and I would laugh along with it, mm-hmm. and then when I was a slightly older child, I was like, I think this might be about something else, and then I understood that it was a sex joke later on. So again, it's just such a I think that part of what makes it good is it has such an amazing cast who are all just so naturally charismatic and funny. You almost, I mean, certainly when I was a kid, I just laughed at everything they said, whether I got it or not, but, and especially the putting on the Ritz part. So anyway.
I will say my favorite runaway character, favorite character was Igor. I think Igor.
Oh, yes,
really,
yeah. And apparently.
Actually, I'll rephrase. My favorite character is Igor's traveling hump.
Yes, there we go.
Yes,
there you go.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, there's, I think, a famous story where Mel Gibson was talking about this film. Mel Brooks was talking about the fact that they had to pass out handkerchiefs to all the guys on set, like white handkerchiefs, so that they could stuff them in their mouths, all the guys on the crew, and not ruin takes from laughing. And they said specifically he remembered the, I'm a rather brilliant surgeon. I could help you with that hump. What hump? And he said he turned and looked at the crew and he said just a sea of handkerchiefs sticking out of everyone's mouths because they'd all stuffed the handkerchiefs into their mouths. So, and it's, again, this
was a
good
joke.
And again, part of the thing is, like, I think the movie, in part of its inception, was even thinking about Marty Feldman because I think Gene Wilder had seen him on TV. We just watched that Gene Wilder Netflix documentary a few months ago and I'm struggling to recall. But then he started writing the script and then had the same agent as Peter Boyle, who they brought on to play Frankenstein and all of that. And it's just, it is just the one of the, it's funny, we saw Fish Called Wanda and we talked about it, one of the best casts of any mm-hmm. comedy of all time, and this is certainly right up there, if not
for
above
sure.
that, in the sense that you have a dynamic that could carry a franchise of movies just in Gene Wilder and Marty Feldman, but then you bring in Cloris Leachman and you're looking at her and you're thinking, well, she's the funniest woman in the history, who plays Frau Blücher. She's the funniest woman in the history of cinema, and then Madeleine Kahn comes on screen and just to say that it is an embarrassment of riches in terms of just great personalities and great cast and all of that. So I don't know. There's every moment on screen is sort of you're being rewarded by revisiting someone who is off screen for a minute who you missed, who you're now getting back to. There's just too many good people in this movie. Cliff, how was your experience watching Young Frankenstein this afternoon?
It was fantastic. Young Frankenstein is one of those interesting movies that energy flow wise, it has a little bit of a slow beginning. Mm-hmm. So you're having a tough time in this packed house reading the energy in the room mm-hmm. at first. It starts the very serious and dramatic. Moving into the matte painting of the house, and then we see the gag with the skeleton, which is a light gag, not huge, but it's the first kind of laugh of the movie. And then it's kind of slowly builds into the good stuff. But basically, by the time we get to Marty Feldman showing up, the entire house was kind of rolling in laughter for pretty much continuously mm-hmm. the whole time.
Yeah.
And so I was very, very happy to see. As soon as that cast kind of assembles itself, mm-hmm. the energy at that point kind of is just great from there on out.
And I think it kind of speaks to that beginning that you're talking about, speaks to one of the things that makes this so great, and in a way makes it sort of the crown jewel in all of out of Mel Brooks's films. As you think about the commitment the movie has to actually portraying that gothic atmosphere. Mm-hmm. So as a long, gag-free, musical, romantic, gothic musical build, push in on that little silly matte painting of the castle at the beginning, and then that long push in all goal to set up that first silly, silly gag of a coffin being opened. There's a skeleton in there. The hands reach in, grab the box, and then the skeleton yanks the box back. And again, that's not the only time. Like, the moment when they're actually, when Peter Boyle is being, you know, brought to life, when the Frankenstein's monster is being brought to life, he delivers a long monologue about conquering nature through science, and a lot, it's very dramatic, and it is played joke-free. And if you were to pick up, basically after he says, here, can you elevate me? And she's like, what, do you want me to elevate you here right now? And then after that joke, for the next couple minutes, you're just in a really great adaptation of Frankenstein for several minutes, and all the way until he's screaming, give my creation life. So it's one of those things that it gives time. It is wall-to-wall jokes, but it gives time to actually being a gothic horror movie at the same time.
And it is, by the way, I'm not a... I've not seen all of the Frankenstein movies in the series. I've not seen Son of Frankenstein and a few others. But apparently by those who know the series well, this is considered part of the canon series starting from the original 1930s Frankenstein here. Yeah. And so it holds up, fulfills all the story requirements, doesn't break reality completely like a Monty Python movie. Mm-hmm. Which definitely is one thing that I like about Mel Brooks movies that distinguishes them from like Monty Python or more kind of nihilistic style humor, is that he holds the story together most of the time without completely shattering reality. Mm-hmm. I think maybe in Blazing Saddles, where they kind of break out into the set of the movie. Yes. That's the closest
Punk rock movie.
That's his most punk rock movie and his most closest to breaking the story world. But this, other than Marty Feldman's hump teleporting from one side to the other, reality is not really defied. In fact, that also was reminded just seeing Marty Feldman, the different reality-breaking things he does throughout. He seems like kind of the Greek Chorus, a nymph, a spiritual creature.
He's the mischievous god in disguise who is watching the story from on high, so he can make jokes about things off-screen. His hump can change sides, all of that kind of stuff. But you can have that within the movie. You can have him playing that and still take the audience on the complete journey of Gene Wilder reconnecting with his grandfather and first and just the brilliance of the opening line. Dr. Frankenstein, my name is Frankenstein, and the whole and his arc back to re-embracing his Frankenstein name, rejecting Madeline Kahn and her superficial nature, marrying Terry Garr. It's a complete arc that not only that, but it literally gives birth to then the arc of the Peter Boyle character who delivers the big monologue at the end about giving him life and all that. So it works really, really well just on a dramatic level while also being just silly, silly, silly fun times the whole time and just having a high, probably even with those couple sequences aside, having a higher ratio of jokes and laughs to runtime than almost any movie ever created while giving minutes often to just being a horror movie at the same time. So I don't know, Taylor, what was your favorite part of this screening experience?
I think this was one of the most interactive audiences we've had in a screening. Maybe that was because we had such a big packed or a small theater packed audience experience with it, but there was just, I just could hear during it, like upper right hand corner group of girls laughed, and then you know the couple to my left would laugh, and then you know the people in front of us would laugh, all at different parts.
Yeah, and when we were leaving, we were literally driving out of the parking lot and heard two gals were going to two different cars, and one of them shouted to the other across the parking lot, "He was my boyfriend."
Yes, yes.
yeah, that was great.
I was gonna say when you were talking about Fran Brueller earlier, best line, like very underrated line, but say it, he was my boyfriend. Yeah, oh, okay.
I got that. That's fantastic. No, I don't know. It's just one of those things. Even, and I remember noticing to your left, there was a couple who clearly, you know, we were at the Alamo, and they were asking the waiter, how do we order, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, they were having like a first-time Alamo experience.
Exactly,
yeah.
It was their first time out at the Alamo. So it's interesting that, you know, a lot of new movies, a lot of Alamos in Austin, but it took Young for probably, you know, it was their of retirement age, probably this guy's favorite movie.
For
brought
sure.
him out to the movie theaters, and yeah, big crowd. So Young Frankenstein is still packing.
Still
them
crowd
in.
Pleaser.
Oh yes, no,
all
most
these
definitely.
Years later.
Most definitely. Yeah, Cliff. What else did we notice about Young Frankenstein this time?
What did we notice about Young Frankenstein? I could stare far deeper into Marty Feldman's weird eyes to the point where I began to wonder what condition does he have, or his eyes outside his skull.
Yes.
Could see many, many more things up close. But no, yeah, I guess the overall experience of, yeah, what we've been talking about already, of an audience being unified in laughter of all different kinds of people of all different ages coming here on a Sunday morning.
No, for
yeah.
sure. No, for sure. And in that way, it was like we were going to church. It was Sunday morning. We went to horror church last week. We're bringing it full circle, everybody. Other people were actually in church, and we at 11:30 a.m. were at the Alamo Draft House with a large congregation of people all feeling the spirit of Mel Brooks and Gene Wilder and Marty Feldman and Madeline Kahn. It is worth noting that this movie, not many people talk about this, but this movie has a very much a spiritual sequel, though it is often overlooked because it is not directed by Mel Brooks, so it is not included in any of the Mel Brooks box sets or Mel Brooks canon. But after Gene Wilder wrote this film, he then went on to write a very similar script that, instead of being a parody of Young Frankenstein, took on Sherlock Holmes and is Sherlock Holmes's smarter brother, where he plays Sherlock Holmes's brother, Mycroft Holmes, just a comedic version of that guy who is very jealous of his much more famous detective brother. And but it's the whole cast returns, with Marty Feldman returning to play Watson, with Madeline Kahn returning as well, and it is directed by Gene Wilder.
Watson with a hump.
Watson with a hump, exactly. It's fantastic. That is also another one of our, and Dom DeLuise is there, and a bunch of really funny people. It is a really, really good movie as well. So if you enjoy, as many people have, Young Frankenstein, seek out Sherlock Holmes's smarter brother. Isn't that right, Cliff?
That's right. That's fantastic. A pretty awesome movie. Dom DeLuise is the only one who feels missing from Young Frankenstein, and that is solved with Sherlock Holmes, yeah, smarter brother.
Absolutely. So moving on to Creature from the Black Lagoon, which we saw the day before. It is interesting because we have been visiting a lot of 50s horror in the last few years. We have, especially, we even brought up last time films like Attack of the Crab Monsters and the kind of lots of the schlockier end, the Roger Corman end of the science fiction films of the 50s. This was the opposite of that. This was a big studio movie with a really fancy monster and a lot of cool underwater photography and a lot of cool stuff. And I was struck this time because we grew up in the era of Jurassic Park and a lot of Michael Crichton stories about groups of scientists coming together to see dinosaurs, or groups of scientists coming together to find smart gorillas mining for diamonds in the Congo, etc., etc. It occurs to me how much of the archetype of the prestige popular fiction, which then became the movies of our childhood, be it the films of based on Stephen King stories or on Michael Crichton books, etc., are all really fancy schmancified versions of essentially the stories and the archetypes laid out in just schlocky 50s fiction. Because we have here essentially Congo. We have here essentially Jurassic Park. We have here essentially a lot of the movies we grew up with in the 90s as prestige pop fiction novels adapted by Steven Spielberg into big prestigious movies. We have a group of scientists, a little bit of infighting. They're here to both trespass into nature, beyond which they will, you know, the nature will turn against them. They will fight their way out of this and learn some sort of lesson. And it feels very, you can imagine, it's only 13 years or so.
You can imagine J-Lo in there.
Yeah, exactly. You can imagine J-Lo and the anacondas. No, so much of that seems to have its core in here, or how we discussed Aliens a bunch, you know, and Aliens, the whole kind of end of Aliens is very similar to another studio science fiction film, Them, from that time, where they go in and to the thing and fight the big alien doozits. So my question is, is how much, and I guess it's not so much a question but a statement, is I really, you feel when you see the movie with an audience as we did, all of that added subtext that a young Michael Crichton or a young Stephen King or a young whomever would have felt in that movie, the romance, that maybe it's not present on a textual level, but the competition of ideas between the more commercially interested Belloc-like guy and the more heroic scuba diver guy, you feel that subtext, and you can imagine them growing up and then actually writing that into books like, well, like all of Stephen King's crap and all of Michael Crichton's crap. Am I right, Cliff?
Oh, yeah. I read a handful of those books.
Yes. But can you feel it?
I can feel it.
I will also agree in a different way that a lot of, I know a lot of girls that will say that they love a good story where the monster is like the romance person or like the coupling is of the monster. And a lot of them do point to one of this movie amongst other of the movies of its era.
Oh yeah, that's the elephant in the room.
Yeah, the elephant in the room is that like a couple years ago. I know that what wins Best Picture doesn't really matter anymore and hasn't for a long time. But just a few years ago that some sort of monster porn fan fiction of Creature from the Black Lagoon literally won Best Picture in the form of The Shape of Water. Which I believe The Shape of Water was actually Guillermo del Toro's pitch for a remake of Creature from the Black Lagoon, which of course the iconic image from the Creature from the Black Lagoon is the girl swimming along the top of the water. Speaking of things that would be remade later with
that
Spielberg.
That made me so... That Thank you yeah, so yeah. much for actually bringing that... I'm going to take the floor for a second. Thank you for bringing up that scene. That scene made me so unnerved and so unsettled in a way that I almost feel like I once upon a time to bring up another movie. I remember watching Silence of the Lambs. Mm. The scene where the villain of that movie that I'm blanking on the name is like in the night vision goggles and almost touching the girl. And I remember talking to my dad being like, I don't really get it, this doesn't really feel very spooky, and my dad being like, you don't get it, at the time it was crazy. I watched that scene of that of the sea monsters creature from the Black Lagoon swimming underneath that girl and that gave me actual chills. That was such a good scene and like if you just picture being her and not knowing that that was so close and you have just already kind of feeling weird about the water, that was such a good scene.
It is interesting. I remember it was really interesting seeing that with you in a theater because you're sitting next to me and I felt you have that like kind of creepy reaction to it, and it's interesting because it's like, again, I that's why I think it's so important or so powerful to see movies with people, because with me, I'm seeing it, I think, through so much distance and so much, you know, I've seen that image a bunch of times before. I'm even thinking at that point, you know, it's like, oh, what a beautiful image, what a beautiful thing, you know, the guy and what its meanings, whereas you are experiencing it on the visceral level of I am that girl, that creature is below the water. And it's really potent to see that it still works as a movie.
Oh,
you know?
For sure.
Not just as an abstraction for snooty film people like myself and Cliff to go and watch, but like it still works as an actual fucking horror movie.
I was literally thinking that during the movie. It's like, because you kind of think, or at least maybe I, is not so much like a intellectual film fan, just like a film fan. You just kind of go, I would assume that some of the older movies, you kind of think like, oh, they're so silly, good for them, they made their movies. But this movie really
requires more suspension of disbelief.
But
no, you were right there.
But I was really right there. And honestly, to that extent, I thought it was really interesting on a technical level just how many of the scenes were underwater. I almost, almost against its credit, kind of assumed very early on that the water scenes were like through a pane of glass. Like they obviously weren't underwater, they were just pretending to be underwater. Yeah. And then very quickly I was like, oh no, this is like a majority underwater camera film, and I just took for granted that you could do that in the 50s.
Well, it's interesting that they talk about the special underwater photography. It's even mentioned in the opening credits of the movie, but specifically that thing you're saying about shooting through a pane of glass is a technique that has been used and was used and is actually the reason for the existence of a movie we just were talking about, which is Attack of the Crab Monsters, which keeps coming up, but it's on the postcard, which Roger Corman made that movie because he was in an aquarium and thought, wow, I could get some really cool scuba footage just by standing up a regular camera in this aquarium, shooting through the glass and having a scuba guy person. I think he was even in an aquarium and saw a guy in scuba gear go and clean something, and he's like, I could just save a lot of money, and so wrote a film that had a lot of underwater sequences and then shot it in like the Los Angeles Aquarium or something on a day it was closed and got a lot of underwater footage. footage. So it is interesting that that absolutely was a technique that was used on that movie.
That's really cool.
And stuff. Whereas this was the fancier studio film that had a little bit more of the that green stuff to throw around. And I'm not talking about fish or fish men or whatever. But no, they had a little bit more of that money, to that cheddar to throw around.
Were they in an enormous tank or was that somewhere?
I mean, they might have been in a tank. Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I actually have no idea. But I think they were, because the opening credits does do talk about special underwater photography and had a special unit for it. So they were underwater as opposed to Corman, who was chilling in an air-conditioned carpet area. Mm-hmm. And Taylor, you would be happy to know that I forget her name, but a lot of people make hay about the fact that the creature was designed by a woman. So,
very cool.
Yes, and so it was built by a team of dudes, but designed in detail by, I forget her name, but and then she was but she actually was, because she was a woman and she was photogenic and she drew the creature, she was actually sent out to promote the movie and do interviews and had photo, you know, photo shoots of her with her drawings and all of that kind of stuff, which is
and
interesting.
And I would love to know why she gave him a double chin. That was the one. He could have been so much better.
Well,
I did like
the fishiness of him there. It's probably, we could see it inflating. You could see the chin inflating. You could see the gills kind of moving as he breathed.
Yeah.
Or at least it created the impression it was inflating as he was. But yeah, I just love the fishy behavior of the head there that was kind of worked into everything.
No, 100%. But I think it was still in an era where we were operating from the assumption that the monster was ostensibly supposed to be frightening and not actually sexually attractive to
that
women.
That was a deep, deep subtext. No one could admit.
Yes, yes. But as opposed to now, where it's like, you know, Guillermo del Toro was like, we got to make the fish man sexy, and then we have the woman fuck the fish right there. And we're like, I guess, man. Fine.
And she gets gills too.
Yeah, I guess. I'm not sure how that works or why we're picturing that or what that movie was about exactly, but sure, man, I'm into it. I think they are remaking it now, though. I think Creature from the Black Lagoon is being big budget remade. But that, it is interesting because that image, you know, Shape of Water, obviously, about having sex with the fish man, it was designed by a woman. I wonder if there is some subtextual sort of female fantasy of having sex with a fish man in that design somewhere, buried
in there.
I think
there's also, maybe, again, probably unintentional, I give you that, but much like how King Kong also had a similar, like, the monsters don't necessarily, like, the monster straight up kills four or five people before he ever, like, is introduced to the woman or even gets closer to the woman. But he never actually tries to harm the woman for whatever reason, even implied or intentional. And I think that's just very, that makes the woman at least feel safe. Like, okay, here, you'll, worst case scenario, Emily's not going to be hurt. You might have to save me from this person, but at least it's not going to hurt me.
No, I mean, I think that's the case with a lot of different monster movies that just embrace that that kind of that very subtextually loaded idea that, you know, I think on the surface it's, you know, you don't want to see the heroine of the film, she has to be imperiled, you don't want to see her slaughtered by the monster, but at the same time, clearly the swimming sequence in this movie, etc., embracing the idea that the creature is angry at the men and slaughtering them and infatuated with the woman. Which then Roger Corman would capitalize on in the film Humanoids from the Deep years later, which is kind of like if a small town is attacked by a bunch of creatures from the Black Lagoon at the same time. Of like, if Alien were Alien, which were this movie, Creature from the Black Lagoon, this would be the aliens. Mm-hmm. And in that movie, he literalizes that subtext by the creatures kill the men and they ravage the women, except he didn't use the word ravage. And then at the end, of course, the women end up giving birth to half-human, half-creature from the Black Lagoon creatures and stuff. And what's funny is that he hired a woman to direct that movie, and she went in and shot very tasteful versions of the creature ravaging, of the creature from the Black Lagoon creatures.
All kind of off-screen stuff.
Where they got to get pulled off-screen tastefully. And then he's like, not good enough, and hired another guy who just shot the footage, which it does not match at all, of just naked women being like thrown on a pile of seaweed and ravaged by the creature from the Black Lagoon. Knock-off guys, and then later on give birth to crazy creature from the Black Lagoon creatures. So in a way, it's a really cool thing when you know that and when you don't, because it's
and
a
when
lot
you don't.
Of editor. It's both versions, both ways work and stuff. So yeah, what I found fun about this also, because you were mentioning, yeah, just sort of slaughtered everybody. It's like it went through, of course, immediately slaughtered all the native people.
Yeah,
first, right
out all
thing.
Yes.
And
we never got to hear about any native myths or anything, because exactly. All the people with the funny haircuts were the ones who were taken out first.
Yes, exactly. And that's the interesting thing about this moment in time. You know, it's kind of a post-World War II. The world has become disenchanted. It's all about science now. We literally have this long explanation of evolution to try and justify the existence of the creature instead of it being a god or a creature of myth or a creature of whatever. And it's even referenced by the characters. And I think that this is, in a way, if you want to give the film credit, something it's kind of aware of, in that it's a contemplation of them trespassing nature and trespassing things they don't understand and suffering the consequences, is they even make reference to the fact that, oh, the natives say that this is the Black Lagoon and people don't come back, and there's stories of a fisherman, and they're like, cool, and then they just go back to talking about goober fish and whatever their theories are. They never think once to turn towards those people and say, tell me about your local legends and myths, and maybe we could discern some valid information. They're like, keep tying shit up, you person who's lived in this jungle your whole fucking life and who has heard stories about this creature. You have nothing useful to tell us, because we took a rock from the bottom and can now test it for its radiation levels to know whether or not, again, they don't follow clues. They no longer are we following, because it's the 50s, hieroglyphics that were on a temple wall. Instead, they're like digging up a rock and testing for it with like a Geiger counter and a bunch of bullshit. And they just, and you know, and in that way, the film is kind of very thematically and resonant, because they all really kind of deserve what's coming to them.
Oh, yeah,
the whole time,
yeah, yeah.
You know, and that's
and they all seem very nonplussed by all the deaths of the crew that take place one by one. The emotional realism you'd get of Nancy Cartwright breaking down in Alien after there's only four of them left. You don't really see any of that.
Well, it was a different era at the time, but
yes, it was after World War II. Everyone had all their friends killed just recently, and so it was fine. You know, when they're once 12 crew members are dead and they're down to four. Yeah. Only at that point do they kind of start to take it seriously. Never a tear shed at any point.
Yeah, and kind of it's an example of something we've talked about a bunch, which is like, even if you look at like the first Mummy movie in 1932, the Boris Karloff Mummy, like it is a curse that brings about the mummy. Mm-hmm. It is an actual curse with magic and stuff. He was cursed by, because he fell in love with the princess or whatever, and they go in and they break the seal just like two in common, and the curse brings about the mummy. And then I think by the time they did, and I'm struggling to recall this, I think like Mummy's Hand or something was 1940, which was the second movie. Ostensibly it's a continuation of the same story, and yet they go back and rewrite it such that it's not a curse, but instead some sort of leaf or some sort of chemical that's derived from a special leaf or something that brings back the mummy. So already they're transiting out of the world across the span of, as we're getting into World War II, we're transiting out of the world of magic, out of the world where there's curses, and as again young Frankenstein points out, you know, this is the 20th century, monsters are passé, and into this weird world of science, where again there's not even a reference now by the time we make it to 1954 to the idea of we'll look into local legends or we'll look into whatever. Instead, it is all we have a little radiation thing, and then they're dumping chemicals into the water to kill all the fish to bring it to the surface, which is a fantastic and subtextually loaded image. And clearly the monster doesn't really want to fuck with them, and they just keep hunting him down until he wants to fight them the whole time. And it's just, so in that way it is very tragic, and one can see the subtext that one would want to more literalize in The Shape of Water or some more tragic version of the creature. I don't know, but it is definitely a film, it is a film of its time, Cliff.
Yeah, and it's clearly also one thing I picked up on having watched Batman Returns recently, the death of the creature. It was clearly riffed by Tim Burton for the death of the penguin in Batman Returns. Well, in Batman Returns, if you remember, with the penguin, and in Creature from Black Lagoon, we have the creature badly wounded. Heroes could finally finish off the creature, but he looks wounded and in bad shape, and all he wants to do is walk back to the water. And the shots kind of mimic each other, especially the shot of the creature sinking past us, still past the camera, very similar to how the penguin sinks past the camera at the end. More blood on the penguin's nose, but otherwise basically the same shot.
Yes, no, I dig that a lot. No, you were absolutely right. No, that is, and it is a good, it is a good. What did you think about the death of the creature, babe?
I honestly was not expecting the... In hindsight, it feels like, duh. But I honestly wasn't expecting the creature to die. I was expecting somehow...
Well, he doesn't. He comes back in the next movie.
Woo! Well, good. But no, I honestly, like, going in blank, I really didn't know where I was going. For some reason, again, slasher brain. I assumed he was going to kill everybody but the girl or some... And then the government would come in. I really didn't know. But I thought it was really
Things
fun.
Hadn't got that harsh yet in horror movies.
That's right.
I need more context, clearly. But yes, no, I thought it was really good. I thought it was sad, and I thought it was a very good scene. I did like that he basically just sunk to the bottom of his own lake, and that was kind of very poetic.
That's
and then immediate credits, which was interesting.
That's the other nice thing about these movies is that they have no credits, so the theater lights come up almost immediately and alarmingly after each one of these movies are over. Was interesting going in. I didn't think about this until we sat down, but the movie started. But of course, it's Creature from the Black Lagoon. It's set deep in the Amazon. As the Amazon is giving up its secrets, it begins with a guy, an archaeologist, going in and finding the hand of the skeletal creature sticking out of a rock, chopping it off, and then going and bringing it.
I think it was more so it broke off.
Well, it doesn't matter. The point is, the whole movie is set against the backdrop of the Amazon giving up all of these secrets, and which seems like maybe an old-fashioned idea from like Rudyard Kipling or something like that. Those old times when people went down rivers and, you know, with Klaus Kinski and had big twirly mustaches, and yet. Right now on Netflix, we just finished season 2 of Ancient Apocalypse with Graham Hancock, where it goes into great detail, and we've heard about this a lot over the years, but you can check it out for yourself. We're now using LIDAR, to take one big step back from that, as the rainforests have been cleared due to deforestation for agriculture, they have in fact started to give up incredible secrets of an unknown past. That is to say, they have begun to give up huge earthworks, big circles and big squares that are only visible from the air and clearly would have taken hundreds of people to build, that are now being revealed because they had been swallowed up by the jungle. What are they? Were they the footings of other structures, temples? Who knows? But now, with LIDAR and drones, LIDAR being, you know, radar but visual or something,
now compact enough to be on a drone, exactly. No longer needs a helicopter.
Exactly. They're now flying over jungles and without clear-cutting all of the trees, are beginning to scan the jungles, see through, and realize that the Amazon is covered with many, many, many structures, circles,
Whole lost cities there, whole lost cities in the Amazon. So the earthworks are some things, but they are connected by various roads and ley lines to whole lost cities.
Yes, yes. And so in that way, it is interesting, especially looking at A Creature from the Black Lagoon right now, the kind of arrogant American Westerners soldier into the Amazon, confident that the superior technologies of their harpoon gun and their diesel engine boat and their winch and their bag full of poisonous chemicals is enough to really conquer all nature, and so they are masters of the world. They have dominion over all things. And now here we are in 2024, and we are using lasers and drones and all sorts of shit to just begin to comprehend the fact that we don't actually comprehend anything about the Amazon, about its history, about the ancient world. There may be fishmen in there. We don't know, actually.
We ought to ask people with the funny haircuts.
Yes, yes. Now, which is actually speaks to now, you know the history better than I do, but they talk about the fact that the earliest reports of conquistadors in that area and stuff reported large cities and all of that kind of stuff, which then, you know, we never discovered because presumably the natives were killed off by diseases brought by the Europeans, and because the jungle grows really, really, really fucking fast, it ate up all those cities. Now, that, of course, was just a theory before, but now we're potentially seeing seeing the footprint of those cities.
The myths of the lost cities of gold hidden in the Amazon are true.
El Dorado.
Can you go? Can someone go and find the treasure buried beneath?
Yes, indeed. And yes, and which is interesting. The seeing that in the context of seeing that in the context of A Creature from the Black Lagoon. Sorry, there's one more point I wanted to make. Cliff, say something while I think of it.
Oh, I'm just thinking. There's a brief part when they're in the cave that some part of the background looks a little
looks
too
like a temple. Yes.
Looks slightly like a temple. So I thought where some of yes. where it was going. I hadn't seen it in a while, but I thought somewhere it was going is that there have been natives who built a temple in the cave to worship the fishman god or something like that. But as it turns out, that was probably just a mistake in the production design or something that kind of looked like a temple only to my eyes.
Yes,
An excellent direction to go if the native myths had been larger than the Black Lagoon where you don't come back from it, kind of a thing. If they had a little bit more juice.
Yes, in a way that represents sort of that poetry between the lines, and that even that was an accident, perhaps, that little temple-looking background in that cave, and yet my mind immediately opened up to, like, obviously here's, this isn't the ancient temple that he was in before, or whatever the thing.
They keep establishing his antiquity. It's 170 million years old, so, maybe it was the temple built 170 million years ago by the fish people.
That's right. And essentially is the plot of Michael Crichton's Congo right there. Something like that, except with gorillas or something.
Pretty close to that.
Cool. Yes. No, lots of good stuff there. It is interesting seeing that now because the Amazon suddenly seems mysterious and frightening, as if it's sort of giving up its secrets in that way. So the monster that is, you know, the creature from the Black Lagoon who comes from this abyss, who comes from this void, who swims underneath us and is all mysterious, is sort of, in a way, revealing himself now and stuff. And it's pretty... and it's pretty cool. And we kind of address, we see the same idea represented in Young Frankenstein in arch form, as he has rejected all nonsense. By he, I mean Frankenstein has rejected all Friedrich. Nonsense. Yes, that's right. Friedrich Frankenstein has rejected all gothic horror, spiritual, weird stuff, even though it is science, to the extent that he has rejected his own name. And then he ultimately comes back to accept it and ultimately comes back to kind of return to that spooky gothic castle's world that seems so very old-fashioned in 1954 when film started with a lesson on evolution and all of that. Isn't that right?
Oh, yeah. It's a throwback way back earlier. Frankenstein is from the 30s, and the story is from way earlier with Mary, as we reminded in the credits, kind of weirdly. You know, screenplay, screen story by Gene Wilder and Mel Brooks, based off characters by Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley.
Yes.
From 1812 or something like that. The novel came out sometime early 1800s. So yes, definitely harkening back to a very pre-World War II era where science and spirituality and gothic horror were kind of all mixed together in this weird poetic mishmash that is captured a little bit even through the lens of this silly movie by Mel Brooks.
No, for sure. It is an interesting thing because we see so much of there's an almost preoccupation in sort of this very industrial world, in this world, the post-atom bomb world of the 1950s, with rejecting and erasing and wiping the slate clean on all of the sort of magical thinking and belief in spooks and specters and goblins and all of that kind of stuff of the pre-atomic age. You know, they're going overboard. They're devoting minutes to trying to ground the idea of a no, this isn't a demon. This isn't a spooky monster. This isn't a creature of myth. You know, this isn't a eldritch monster indicative of the fact that our parents were right and there were in fact monsters and things in the time before. None of that. No. There's a goober fish that exists somewhere that has lungs, and evolution has been happening since the beginning of time.
Kind of look like feet.
Exactly. And so because of these things, and because of a long and narrated science explanation in the beginning, that made it more possible to believe in a humanoid monster, demon, crazy thing that comes out of the past. And which, by the way, another interesting thought, I was thinking, we brought up the mummy before. 1932 versus The Mummy's Hand, I think, I'm probably getting the title wrong, 1940, is that even in 1932, I think, I forget what her name was, I think Zita Johann or something like that, who was the female lead in The Mummy, she practiced Kabbalistic magic as part of her acting practice and taught that to other actors, so they would literally, their acting practice, rather than The Method or Stanislavski or all this crap that came later based upon the psychological models of mind, was based on a spiritual model. And so she would use Kabbalistic magic to teach acting. And so the idea was, if you were going to play Medea, and this is, I've heard someone else say this in an interview, but the idea is, if you were going to play Medea, you would channel Medea and become Medea, and then you would be Medea on stage.
You know, Tyler Perry's Medea?
No. The Greek. You know mythology. You know Medea.
I don't recognize
Cliff, remember Medea?
Medea, famous Greek play. She's the she marries Jason from Jason and the Argonauts, has kids with him, but then because they have some marital strife, she murders their children, like Susan Smith in the 90s, yes. Drowns them or something, yes, in a car, yes, yes. And says some Puerto Rican guy did it.
Yes, exactly.
I forget the details. It's more some fancy in Greek.
Yes, yes,
I'm
yes.
Actually, and so then, excited. That's a myth I'd never heard about. Side note.
Then she dies horribly, I believe, in some form.
I forget exactly how it resolves.
She dies like a poison blanket.
Yeah, is it a Sophocles play or a Euripides? I think it's Euripides or something. One of the big three Greek tragedians.
Not many of them survived, so we have only so many. But we did, and then Cliff and I, when we were in high school, did the Trial of Medea, which was a thing that they put kids through for history class, where we put Medea on trial and each argued different sides and wore ties.
It's a way to unify the education of Greek mythology and courtroom procedure.
Yes,
they're trying to do a lot of
combining history and social studies together in one lesson.
Exactly, that's a big time saver.
I'm such a Greek mythology nut, and I'm shocked that there's something that's so extensive that I have not. It's so like wow.
Yeah, I haven't thought. I wish I had more, but I haven't thought of that since high school. But the point is, Zita Johann in 1932 lives in a Hollywood and a world, and you see this in Sunset Boulevard and other things, where magic and the occult and lodges and Freemasonry is a background to all of our lives. And the spiritual interpretation of events and things is part of all of our lives. And you can read H.P. Lovecraft and Edgar Allan Poe and all of this kind of gothic shit. And by 1954, we have, again, a movie about a demon emerging from an ancient temple, and people have talked about him and blah, 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 blah. But instead now, all of the justifications seem to almost definitionally be about rejecting any idea that there's anything supernatural at all about this big, goofy fishman, as if the post-World War II America would reject the post- atomic bomb America, the America that was on its way to the moon, would reject that out of hand. So,
oh yeah,
there you go. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, fun stuff, fun stuff. Mm-hmm. And so the classic image of the creature from the Black Lagoon swimming below the lady was very effective. Taylor, you saw Shape of Water. Did you find it to be a faithful adaptation of the subtext of that image?
It's been many, many years since I've seen Shape of Water, and I love Shape of Water liking it. I like Guillermo del Toro's films a lot, actually. I think the only criticism I have of his movies overall, in my uneducated opinion, is any movies that he has that has a historical component, I don't gravitate towards, like for example Pan and for Shape of Water. I love all of the monster stuff. I love the main girl stuff. I even like the campy corny villain dude, like it's fun, but everything I don't like is just the time period, which is part of the movie. But
I understand kind of what you mean, and that I feel like in the same way that, and Cliff and two other people who in the world will understand what I mean when I say this, but kind of like the novels of Victor Hugo have much better written, I think, than the movies of Guillermo del Toro, but they have these long historical essays and digressions that are meant to somewhat ground his fantasy or his idea, these bigger characters, more romantic characters, in a historical time period. And when you look at something like Pan's Labyrinth, obviously all the fantasy stuff is so much more appealing than all of the World War II or fascist Spain stuff.
Yeah, Spanish War,
where it is, again, I like that stuff, but again, it feels poorly integrated perhaps with the other stuff, which is very much more appealing, and that's what everyone sort of remembers about the movie. And I kind of feel the same way about a lot of his movies, whether it's Crimson Peak or even Shape of Water, where they there's themes that I like, and he's retelling horror movies in poetic ways where I see the same subtext he's trying to bring out in a romantic way, but he seems to reject the idea of actually making them horror movies, actually making some of, like, again,
something actually scary.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is that Shape of Water, it's like when you literalize my, and I guess this is my point, somehow you would assume when you see that romantic image of the woman swimming below the creature and creature from the Black Lagoon, you would assume then that for a more sophisticated audience where sexual subtext doesn't need to be buried quite below the surface, that if you then literalize that subtext and have the creature and the woman actually fall in love with each other, then that would be even more powerful, right? And yet it doesn't work. It somehow seems to, in the same, you lose the danger, you lose something about it that makes it work. You lose the tension between the attraction and the repulsion of the fish man.
It feels less naughty somehow.
Yes, it feels less naughty. It somehow feels less satisfying. And I feel like the same thing with Crimson Peak, which again says this is not a ghost story. It's a story with ghosts in it. And it's like, and yet our relationship to those ghosts is one that I think spiritually is can be characterized by fear, because ghosts remind us that this world is temporary, that all of these things are passing away, that this is a veil. That, and we experience that as either, you know, catharsis and, you know, ecstatic experience, which is not what horror movies are about, or as fear. And so you make the ghost scary, and that organizes and dramatizes a lot of the esoteric ideas and a lot of the thematic ideas in a ghost story. You know, that, think of The Haunting or something like that. Think of fucking The Others or something like that. Go ahead.
By the way, there's the elephant in the room of our conversation, which we are having a conversation about both Creature from the Black Lagoon and Young Frankenstein. Yes. And Young Frankenstein is a movie where the creature actually does kidnap a woman and they do follow
her. That is a good point. Yes,
so it's a good point of noting that a comedy version, a comedy parody of Creature from the Black Lagoon, where they fall in love in the end, might work. I can dig that. I think I would dig that. What Mel Gibson, or not, Jesus, Mel Brooks's version, Mel Gibson's version of Creature from the Black Lagoon. I can't even imagine different. That. That would be
less, a little bit fewer Borscht Belt jokes.
Fewer Borscht Belt jokes, a lot more torture, oddly enough. Yes. Somehow that'll get worked in there.
Yes, obviously.
But, and of course, some anti-Semitism.
Freedom!
Yeah. But, no, the Mel Brooks version of Creature from the Black Lagoon obviously would have the creature falling in love with the scientist's frigid fiance while the scientist is falling in love with the other chick on the boat who's the lab assistant, who's the one who goes in the water and stuff.
No. Which, if you caught the jokes, it was very much, it was frigid to the scientist but was not frigid to other people. She made the joke where she tried to say to the monster that she was a virgin, but she got to the V and then didn't finish the word. And then she quickly gave in to the monster. And then she says, as he leaves, "You men are all the same," as if she's had multiple experiences. So poor Professor Frankenstein.
Yes, I love the Madeline. What is the joke? What's just six or seven or eight quick ones, and you're off to the boys to brag. You better keep your mouth shut. Yes, I'm in love. No, that again. I feel with Young Frankenstein, you get into a complicated problem discussing it in the same way you do when we're discussing the Terminator, because everything that was born of the Terminator in terms of its influence, its acclaim, the careers of everyone involved, or at least of Schwarzenegger and Cameron, everything is so superlative and hyperbolic in terms of what followed from that film that you sound absurd talking about its greatness. And I feel the same thing is true of Young Frankenstein. It's just that it has a perfect cast, a cast where kind of each one of the people is transcendently good in every moment, and it all came together, and yet it works as a gothic horror movie. It works somehow dramatically the best of any Mel Brooks movie as a story, and I think that was the Gene Wilder influence. I mean, it's so superlatively good that to this day, at 11, when a lot of people could be doing a lot of other things in the city of Austin, because there's a lot of movie theaters playing a lot of different stuff right now, a crowd full of just a bunch of, you know, pot-smoking hippies and old retirees and young people with their kids and girls with friends.
I saw mom and daughters and whatnot, yeah.
crowded in to see Young Frankenstein at 11:30 in the morning. So again, it's just one of those things that still has that power. And man, it is just way better to see a movie. And we've, like I said, tried to show it to Taylor at home, mm-hmm. you know, and when you see the movie at home, it does not have that same, you don't feel everything as strongly. And even, you know, it couldn't quite pull Taylor to the other side of the screen. We suddenly sit down in a movie theater, everyone's dialed in, everyone's laughing, and you were just busting a gut the whole time. So you are my canary in the coal mine. So I'm just gonna bring you around in a cage and just put you in a movie theater, and if you laugh, I'll know it's working.
It's funny because it was almost the other people, because the whole movie's funny. The whole movie's got great jokes, got a great sense of humor once you're on board. But if you're not akin to the sense of humor right away, I think it was just me enjoying the audience enjoyment of the humor. Mm-hmm. And then by the time, maybe like 10 or 15 minutes in, when I got to quote unquote jokes that were like my jokes, I was already on board. I was much more adaptable. Mm-hmm. And then you're off to the races. You're just watching all of the things unfold on screen. Honestly, throughout the whole movie, you're getting more and more characters that just add to the fun of it. Like you don't get like the constable with the wooden hand yes. and whatnot until like three quarters of the way through the movie. And he's hilarious.
Yeah,
you know,
no,
he adds
no, he
a lot
great.
Of fun to the big mob. Scene.
Yeah, he's the Nazi in The Producers, who writes Springtime for Hitler.
I have not
yeah.
seen The Producers.
See, we should watch The Producers mm-hmm. when it plays in a movie theater.
Plays in a theater.
So, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so we don't have to necessarily talk this to death. So we transition to some of the ending things for the podcast. Cliff, this is an interesting, I think I know the answer mm-hmm. now that I think about it, but who we award each week the Full Metal Jacked Award to the most jacked, the most physically jacked guy or gal in the movies that we have seen. So we have both Creature from the Black Lagoon, which honestly had a lot of dude, who had a lot of dude
flesh.
There's
plenty of beefcakes in there. Yes. 50s beefcakes before people figured out yes. lifting weights yet.
Yes. I mean, we had two guys who were stripped to the waist the whole time mm-hmm. fighting with each other and had, especially for the 50s, pretty significant upper body mass.
Both oh, yeah. They were yeah. both 50s fit, absolutely.
Yeah.
But of course, the winner of the Full Metal Jacked Award has to go to Peter Boyle, where even yes. if his size is somewhat faked. They say he's 7 feet tall. Really, Peter Boyle, I imagine, is maybe 6'2" mm. with some big platform shoes.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
it helps that Gene Wilder is a short, slight man, and yes. Marty Feldman is always hunched over all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So with the platform shoes, he does appear enormous,
yes.
Which is fantastic. Actually, the only time it doesn't work is Gene Hackman, who's a pretty big guy, mm-hmm. who's standing next to him, doesn't really sell the hugeness of him.
Yeah.
But overall, of course, the speech Gene Wilder gives, he had the in terms of strength and sheer muscle mass, he is the Olympian ideal.
Mm-hmm.
He is Peter Boyle.
No,
in,
absolutely.
As the monster,
and has an enormous Schwanstufer.
That's bonus
says.
Points.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And no, I was also just thinking this time about what a gem of a scene the scene between Peter Boyle and Gene Hackman is, because again, you get. It feels like a role that was written for Mel Brooks to play himself, because it feels very similar to Yogurt and many of the other kind of crazy old men with a beard roles. And yet, you know, Gene Wilder and Gene Hackman had worked together. They were both in Bonnie and Clyde early in their mm-hmm. career, you know. And so he was able to bring Gene Hackman into the movie to play that. And it's what makes that scene, and as hilarious as I'm sure Mel Brooks would have been playing the old blind man, you can even feel the Mel Brooks lines in there. It's like, oh, a stranger, a very big stranger. You would have been the tallest one in your class. Mm-hmm. It feels like a very Mel Brooks line he's writing for himself.
Yes.
And yet you get two of the best actors of the 70s. You know, you have fucking Peter Boyle from Taxi Driver and from Joe and from all these fucking movies. And you have Gene Hackman from The Conversation and from fucking everything. He's Gene Hackman.
French Connection. Gene Hackman, big star.
You have these two guys dressed in silly costumes as Frankenstein and as the old man from Bride of Frankenstein, the blind man, doing silly blind guy gags. And they're fucking hilarious. They're great. And you just, again, it's just under what other circumstances in that year, 1974, would we have gotten those two guys in that scene? It is a gem of a scene as a result. All the way right through the end with, where are you going? I was going to make espresso.
And he just, that Gene Hackman, literally from the, when you're pushing in at the beginning of the scene, and he's like counting his rosary beads, and he's fucking in it. He is Gene Hackmaning in that moment. He is feeling the truth of that character. And he's selling it with his full Gene Hackmanness in that moment. So, and it's just like the big push in on the castle at the beginning, or the minutes it takes for them to bring Peter Boyle back. I mean, by having Gene Hackman there really playing the blind man, it suddenly somehow evokes some of the pathos of the blind guy from Bride of Frankenstein.
He's at least as good an actor as the guy who played him in Bride of Frankenstein. Exactly. I don't even know that guy's name. Yes. So there you go.
It's weirdly, it's a parody of that scene, but in some ways it's, I think it's dumb. And he's setting his thumb on fire, and yet it also it resonates in the same way that scene does, or at least it did for me.
At the end of that scene, I literally turn to you and go, "God, poor guy."
Yeah, I know. It's just, yes, well, you know, if he hadn't poured so much soup in his lap, then
so much soup.
I know he's got to be careful with that. So, yes,
that all of that was used for such stupid. That all of that pathos was used for such stupid Mr. Magoo gags. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Cool. Well. As we leave you all for the rest of your week, we could speculate as to what type of life lessons that we can discern from Young Frankenstein and from Creature from the Black Lagoon, what kind of lessons we can take into the future of this podcast, and what lessons you, our humble viewers, can take into the rest of your week. So we did a tarot draw, as we always do, prior to the episode, and we drew a card and asked what lessons that Young Frankenstein and Creature from the Black Lagoon have for us and for this audience. Taylor, would you like to show us the card now? The card is the Queen of Pentacles inverted. Interesting. So this is actually this is great. So the Queen of Pentacles, here, I'll show it to this right here. If you notice in the bottom corner right there, do I have it right? Yes, there we go. Right there, the Queen of Pentacles has a rabbit on the card. Mm. And the Queen of Pentacles is the full appreciation of the Earth suit as a suit. But the rabbit represents fertility. Notice how she is completely surrounded by plants. Mm-hmm. She is completely surrounded by mountains and earth and all of that kind of stuff. The top of the card is wreathed in a bunch of vines and stuff. So as it's representing fertility, or it's representing the beginnings of life, we receive this card inverted, which means that the lessons that we learn in Young Frankenstein is that man, for all of his capabilities, does not possess the ability to create life that is only reserved for spooky, spooky spirits, which is really the big takeaway from the 20th century. We're mostly good at nuclear weapons. We're not that good at creating things, life and that sort of stuff. It is also inverted, just like in The Creature from the Black Lagoon, as we are not good at necessarily cultivating life, but killing it. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Cliff.
And also, about fertility creating life, Young Frankenstein does invert that because... Mm-hmm. Frankenstein is unable. The meta lesson is, of course, don't create life. Science shouldn't do mm-hmm. all this. But it ends with two couplings of two people getting married, getting together, and presumably children will come forth from that.
Good
so perhaps
call.
The lesson of Young Frankenstein is science perhaps shouldn't mess with nature. Everyone should just get married and have kids the old-fashioned
exactly.
way. That's how we create
that
life.
The only way we can turn this inverted Queen of Pentacles upright is by returning to natural ways of creation, that is to say, boning. Lots of boning.
With enormous
babies.
Schwanstuckers.
Exactly. Gene Wilder inherited the Schwanstucker, as you found out at the end of the movie. He inherited the Schwanstucker from Peter Boyle, so he had his Olympian dong, but go ahead.
I do wonder if the Frankenstein's monster's wife, the bride of Frankenstein, is disappointed by that fact.
I know. Did he lose? We never find out if he loses his Schwanstucker. We don't know, actually, but he did get at least get his brains.
He got some mojo.
And he's reading the Wall Street Journal at the end. And it really is. And then, of course, we also have the creature and Madeline Kahn ending up, and perhaps he is also fertile, and they will also have kids. And I mean, if you count Shape of Water, there's three couples because eventually the monster gets together with the lady. Or if you want, you could you don't even have to go to the Shape of Water. We could go just to Humanoids from the Deep, Roger Corman, where finally the relationship is consummated, and many women give birth to half creature from the Black Lagoon.
Consummated
creatures
feels like
as God intended. This is God intended it to happen. Yeah, so I think the lesson, what can the audience now take from this? What lessons, important lessons, through the filter of this, these lessons about fertility, what lessons can they take into their week and into their lives from these films? We've gone to movie church here this week. We've learned a few things. We've learned the Promethean lesson, you know, that man should not mess with certain things, that the creation of life and the barrier of death is perhaps impassable, and that we should instead defer some of those things to the greater mystery, that sort of a thing. We've learned if you're on your phone a lot, don't do that. Don't do technology. Do babies. Like, go and, like, have a baby or something like that. I think because creating life is important, according to this card.
So if you use your phone, you'll turn into an undead monster.
Yes, exactly.
I think that's the basic idea.
Mm. Cool.
Or a fish creature.
That's right.
You don't want that. Don't use your phones, everybody.
Don't use your phones. We've got it.
Not even to watch this podcast.
That's
actually
right.
Only to watch this podcast.
Only to watch this podcast, please.
All right. Well, I think on that note, everyone, I think we have really gotten to the bottom of some things. We've essentially solved the entire 20th century, in addition to solving AI on our Terminator episode and the issues of life and death and spirituality in our Beetlejuice episode. So we might have to wrap up the whole podcast, because I think we're going to solve all of the greater mysteries of the universe in just a few episodes.
Little by little.
So, little by little. All right, everyone. Well, then, for the crowded theater, we will see you next week. I am Kyle.
I am Taylor.
I am Cliff.
Later, y'all. We will see you at the movies.